you again for coming down and talking with us today. I think that your council has probably already told you a little bit about the commission and what we're doing, but I'll just give you a high-level overview. The Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission is a bipartisan commission that was established by Congress last May to investigate the causes of the financial crisis. And the statute that created the commission specifically tasked it with looking at institutions that failed or would have failed but for the receipt of exceptional government assistance. Unfortunately, AIG falls into that category, so your work there is relevant to our inquiry. Separately, the statute also tells us to look at the role of complex financial derivatives in the financial crisis, and so we're particularly interested in the financial products group at AIG and their business in credit default swaps. So that's sort of the basics on why we're here.
Okay.
And I think it probably would help us if we could just start with your background at AIG.
Sure.
How long you were there and where you started.
Okay. So I started in early 2000. I joined from General Re Financial Products, which is a very similar setup as AIG Financial Products, and joined as a managing director in the corporate, basically structured credit group within AIG Financial Products in Wilton, Connecticut. And was at AIG FP for 7 years. I left there roughly 3 years ago.
Could you put an approximate date on that?
Yeah, so 2000 to the beginning of 2007. So I think I left either late January or early February 2007. So it's been 3 years since I've been there. But I was there for 7 years, managing director. It's AIG Financial Products, although it's part of a very large company, it was a very small company. It seemed that way, at least, and it was run like a very small company, especially when I joined. It probably doubled in size during that period, from, maybe 150 people total, including back office globally, to almost, 350, 400 by the time I left, or maybe 350 by the time I left. So lots of changes there, but my role basically changed as well because it's a small organization. But for the most part, I was involved with credit derivatives with regard to the way we broke it out was I was in charge of doing credit derivatives where the underlying is corporate credit, so IBM and GM and all those sort of things, and then. The credit derivatives group was, at least in North America and Wilton, was split between corporate credit, which I was running, and anything other than corporate credit, which is essentially asset-backed security-backed credit derivatives or residential commercial mortgage things. And almost during that entire period, Alan Frost ran that part of the group.
What was the split in terms of the people in Connecticut versus the people in London?
Yep.
Were there any other offices involved in FP, or is it just London and Wilton, Connecticut?
There's London, Wilton, and there's an office in Tokyo and a small satellite office. There's a satellite office in Paris and a satellite office in Hong Kong, but for the most part, a bulk of the people, the place was managed out of London by Joe Cassano, and the credit business, the credit derivatives business, was all managed out of London. Wilton had marketers and structurers, if you will. So, at least for the credit derivatives business, we were satellite, almost like a satellite office to some extent. But the company's origin was in New York and Connecticut, in New York initially in Connecticut, and therefore a lot of the middle to back office people were there. So if you actually looked at the split at AIG Financial Products, over half of the company is middle to back office, and a vast majority of those people are in are in Wilton, a lot of the front offices. If you actually look at the front office, there's more front office people in London than there are in Wilton. But with regard to the credit derivatives business, it was very small. I mean, it was probably people totally involved in credit derivatives, whether it's asset-backed securities or corporate credit. There's probably maybe five total.
In London and Connecticut?
In just Connecticut.
Okay.
And then in London, and by the way, that also includes, that's not only a sales / structuring person who faces, you know, the banks and executes trades with banks, but it also includes an analyst, it includes a credit officer in some cases, and so that when I say four or five people in Connecticut, that includes not just the person executing, but all support. But the credit business, which was, the book was managed, or the risk was managed out of London, and it was run by Andrew Forrester, all credit derivatives, and all assets that the company purchased, run out of London. And that group might have been, you know, 12 people, 10 to 12 people, including kind of analysts and so forth. So reasonably small given the size of the company's book of business.
So what percent of FP's total business would the credit derivatives book have been, do you think?
It's interesting. There are a lot of ways of measuring it. A lot of them are what I would call kind of irrelevant measures. But I think the best way of describing it is kind of revenues that's generated from the business. Because notional, you know, if you actually looked at AIG Financial Products, it's a derivatives company, interest rate, foreign currency, commodities, credit derivatives. Credit derivatives was like, you know, a couple hundred billion. The overall book of derivatives, including interest rate swaps and so forth, were measured in the trillions, is my guess. It's at least a trillion. So So I think notional is a really bad measure to some extent. However, when it comes to revenues, the credit business, the business that basically was run by Andrew Forrester in London, which includes these, let's say, 15 people, 10 to 15 people, roughly globally, that business generated anywhere from $100 million to $300 million a year in bookable revenues for the firm, roughly. And during that period, and it really fluctuated pretty dramatically throughout that period, versus, you know, and again, the revenues of the company fluctuated. So I would say that it was anywhere from 10 to 20% of the revenues of the company. In some cases,
when you say the company, you mean FP?
Of FP.
Okay.
FP. When we talk about the company, it really, really, we felt completely separate from the parent. A big business, but not, you know, a vast majority of the business, which, you know, it's pretty ironic, actually, to think that this book of business that was executed was a very small, on a separate basis, generated very, you know, on a standalone basis, this subprime ABS CDO business, was a very small part of the revenues of the company, it seemed at least at the time.
When you said that FP felt really separate from AIG,
yeah,
the parent company,
mm-hmm,
for what reason? Did you ever interact with anyone at the parent level?
Occasionally. The origins are one where it was really set up as a separate company, but benefited from a unconditional guarantee by the parent. A very valuable guarantee, which enabled this small company to execute derivatives and have a competitive advantage, because when someone wanted to do some sort of hedging transaction through an interest rate swap, through a foreign currency swap, a long data transaction, they want to do it with a highly rated institution. AIG was one of the very few AAA institutions out there, and so it was a huge competitive advantage when this company was set up, and it was set up by a fellow named Howard Sosin well before my time, as almost like a partnership, but a separate company, profit sharing, completely separate, you know, healthcare and payroll and bonus system, everything. The only thing, the only kind of connection to the parent, quite frankly, was the parent was on the board, and they provided a guarantee.
So FP had a separate board of directors.
It had a separate board of directors, but you know, the company essentially is controlled by the parent. However, it was run all the way, at least when I was there, independently. Completely independently, with my interaction with the parent was minimal at best.
To your knowledge, I mean, okay, so yeah. Who did you report to?
It changed over periods of time, but I started off reporting to a fellow named Steve Sitfer, who was the head of marketing at the time in 2000.
How do you spell his last name?
S-I-T-V-E-R. And so he was a, you know, very senior guy running North American operation at the time. And, you know, probably, you know, 4 years later, roughly, is when the reporting line switched over to a fellow named John Capetta, C-A-P-P-E-T-T-A. And he was the head of he took over as the head of marketing when Steve Sitfer became the chief operating officer, so the number two guy underneath Joe Cassano at the same. When Joe got promoted to CEO during that period, Steve got promoted to COO. So they kind of both moved up together, and John Capetta then became the head of marketing at the time, and then I started reporting to him. And then near the end, I got switched over at the time where I inherited Al Frost's book of business. I got moved into the credit trading group and started reporting to Andrew Forrester at that exact time.
And what was the approximate date of that?
That was very beginning of 2006, so January 2006. Is when I switched over from reporting to Andrew Forrester, John Capetta to Andrew Forrester in London.
So to your knowledge, were there any direct reporting lines between anyone in FP, for example, Cassano, to anyone at AIG?
There was. You know, it was always, you know, the way it worked was it was almost entirely the CEO had a direct line to Hank Greenberg. Hank Greenberg was extremely hands-on. And that was almost a day-to-day, hour-to-hour interaction. But obviously when Hank left, the place kind of changed a lot. And there was not, it was, even though I think it was Marty Sullivan who took over at that stage, but there was a period, there was definitely a period where, yes, Joe reported to Martin Sullivan, but it was, you know, there was this transition period with the company where it became a little gray on how, you know, let's put it this way, the interaction between those two slowed down dramatically once that switchover occurred. But that was the main reporting line. And including, like, there's a head risk officer whose name escapes me at the parent.
Would that have been Bob Lewis?
Yes, Bob Lewis, yes. So there was a lot of interaction with Bob Lewis and Hank Greenberg or whoever was the CEO, not at my level, at Joe's level.
Mm-hmm. So I'm interested, before 2006, did you have any involvement in the business writing credit default swap protection on the asset-backed CDOs?
No, not at all, no.
Okay.
Including the multi-sector.
Including the multi-sector. Just to, you know, clarify, we split up the world, myself and Al Frost, where I was in charge of doing corporate credit, and Alan was doing everything else, and everything else. And that was well before 2006. That was how that business started, probably in 2002, is my guess. It started as a small trickle and became a very, it grew exponentially from 2002. But that business was entirely Alan's business, and my business was corporate credit.
So you said you came in as a managing director,
yeah,
and that you were the head of the marketing,
yeah,
side on the corporate credit.
Yeah.
Could you describe a little bit your job duties?
Yeah. First of all, managing director at AIGFT is, I mean, everybody's kind of a reasonably senior person. It's a small place, and it doesn't mean anything. And being the head of the group means I'm the head of myself. So it's kind of unusual that way. So very, you know, maybe an analyst and stuff like that. So it really sounds a lot more than it is. But so my role changed over time, but for the most part, what kept us busy from basically, kept me busy in particular from 2000 to probably early 2004 was doing super senior swaps where the underlying credit default swaps, where the underlying was a diversified pool of corporate credit obligations. So typical transaction might be 150 equally weighted investment grade corporations, so the IBMs of the world and so forth. And what AIGFT had a business of doing, very odd business, is providing protection, like disaster protection, off of a portfolio of corporates to the banks. Where, for example, if 25% of the S&P 100, the top 100 companies in the world, 25% defaulted, we would start taking losses in excess of that. Is a kind of the general idea, and so it was disaster type of protection, and these were all custom tailored transactions where a bank would come to us and basically say, hey, we want to buy protection from you. We've bought protection from other people all the way below you, but at a certain level, let's work on a portfolio and let's figure out where you attach or what point do you start absorbing losses. And what we would always try to do is to structure a transaction where the transaction is virtually riskless and get paid a small premium, you know, to do that. And we were one of the few guys who can do that, because if you think about it, no one wants to buy disaster protection from someone who's not going to be around. The idea is to find someone who's large enough where if that event happened, that they'd be able to collect on that insurance. It's kind of like what Warren Buffett talks about, the value of Berkshire Hathaway, is to basically say that we're the last guy standing, and that's why we can provide this catastrophic protection. That was AIGFP's, you know, sales pitch to the street or to the banks, saying that, you know, we're one of the largest capitalized AAA companies. We can provide you this protection. And so there wasn't a huge amount of competition for these transactions. So
was that business already up and going when you joined?
The credit derivatives business was, you know, it was kind of at the very early stages at that stage. So that business was up and running. They had already done a few billion dollars, or maybe $10 billion plus, by the time I joined in early 2000. And, you know, my business, we probably put on something like $50 billion over $50 billion of corporate credit transactions, super senior transactions off of corporate credit from 2000 to the end of 2003, when there was, you know, when the pricing was very attractive, They were generally, you know, 5-year deals.
Like, what sort of premium would you get? What sort of?
There, it was roughly 15 basis points. So very tiny amount you get paid to take this disaster relief transaction. But so it didn't deviate that much from that. And interestingly enough, the super senior market in general, the idea of whatever the underlying is, if you create a essentially riskless transaction, the fee roughly is going to be in the 10 to 15 basis point level. And that's not that dissimilar to what the subprime CDO is.
Well, I was going to ask, because based on what I know so far, it sounds relatively similar to the multi-sector CDO business at FP.
It is.
Was the multi-sector modeled off of what your role was doing?
Yeah, it's all kind of the same analysis. It's all basically very statistical, and it involves basically running large Monte Carlo simulations, trying to figure out every scenario that possibly can happen, running it and verifying that within, you know, a 99.9% confidence interval that you're going to sustain zero losses. So it's a very statistical, it's based on a lot of historical analysis, like default and recovery analysis. And there's a huge amount of history on corporate credit where you can go back, not 100 years, but between 60 and 75 years through multiple cycles and be able to understand and be able to kind of gauge how bad can get and to size that attachment point, to put that attachment point at a level where you have a certain margin for error over the worst case scenario and be able to attach where you can, again, 99.9% of the time you feel certain that you're not gonna ever sustain a loss.
So as I understand it, there was a model developed by a man named Gary Gorton for the multi-sector business. Was that a model that you used in the corporate credit side as well?
It's a different model, but it's the underlying approach is identical. It started off, the ABS CDO business didn't really start until around 2002. Before that, the corporate credit business was in existence, and so Gary had developed the original model for the corporate credit business, and then when Alan kind of took over this ABS CDO business, he developed a similar model for the ABS CDOs early in 2002, is my guess. And so the approach is the same, which is simulations of defaults based on correlation of the underlying assets in the pool, the diversity of the pool, and trying to figure out what the worst case scenario is.
But it was still based on like ratings downgrades and...
In corporate credit it was the ABS CDO business, it's less ratings based and it's more based on historical. That's a good question. I actually don't know enough about how the details are with regard to the ABS CDO model.
So as part of your job in the corporate credit side, would you have been drafting or negotiating the contracts?
Yes. Well, not drafting, and what we would do is negotiate it, and we would always have a lawyer.
But these would have been the ISDA master agreement and the confirmations?
Yeah, exactly.
Are there other relevant documents?
No, there aren't. Okay. That's the fascinating thing about a credit derivatives is that the documentation is actually fairly simple. It's a confirm, and it's an ISDA master. AIG Financial Products has thousands of counterparties, clients, including all of the banks, and they already have an ISDA master in place in which they execute interest rate, credit derivatives, foreign currency, commodity derivatives, everything off of this one ISDA master with a specific bank. So, no wisdom masters need to be negotiated because they're already negotiated, but the con firm does. And so when we like if I executed a corporate super senior credit derivative transaction, we negotiate the con firm. We have an in-house counsel, and we typically have an outside counsel firm involved as well, depending on the need.
Who were the in-house lawyers who would have worked on this?
For my deals, it was a fellow named Bob Powell, there are a couple others, but I'm just trying to think with regard to Alan's deal, it was Jake's son, S-U-N. Jake was involved in doing, all of the legal work behind Alan's deals.
And who was the outside counsel?
Outside counsel is Cadwallader, typically on these deals.
But would it be primarily, so the lawyers draft it, but it would be primarily you who negotiated?
Yeah, I think that's fair.
And who are the top, say, 5 or 10 corporate credit counterparties that you worked with?
It was the usual suspects. It would be Goldman Sachs, it would be Merrill Lynch, it would be SocGen and Calion and all of your big European. There are probably 10 major ones, but we did business with pretty much everyone.
And the way that the business worked, would they typically come to you? Or would you, as FP, sort of go out and market?
They would come to us almost entirely. They would come to us with a deal, typically the way, whether it be an ABS CDO deal or a corporate credit-based deal, typically they come with a portfolio, and there's a negotiation process, a negotiation of the underlying credits. So out of 150 credits, we'll send those names over, the portfolio over to London, and there's analysts who go through those names, and they might kick out 25 names, and we say, okay, of that portfolio you sent me, let's kick out 25, let's put in these 25, and there's this negotiation. So there's a negotiation of the underlying credits in the pool as well as the attachment point. So we can create a little bit more buffer by increasing our attachment point or where we participate. And so there's this negotiation. But that can happen reasonably quickly depending on the situation.
Okay. So before I get into more about your work at FP, could you tell me just a little bit about why you left and where you went and what you're doing now?
Yeah, so I left in early 2007. I left to set up basically what is called a credit derivative product company, a standalone company, which does very similar things to what I was doing at AIG FP, which is our single most, what we really focus on is doing corporate credit based only super senior transactions, through a standalone company, separately capitalized, and we go to the banks and we're the company is rated AAA, was rated AAA, and so the company gets a standalone AAA rating, it's separately capitalized, and it executes transactions where it really looks like an insurance company, where it does the same thing, where it writes protection at a very high level, gets paid a fee, but separately capitalized and no guarantees or anything. So that's what we ended up setting up.
What's the name of it?
It's called Quadrant, Quadrant Structured Credit Products.
And is it based in Connecticut?
It is. My company's 8 people, so we're a small company. That market's changed dramatically through this whole crisis where there are no longer... One of the deals behind us doing this is that we raise capital, both debt and equity capital, which helps provide, if there are any losses on these transactions, that capital is used to pay claims against losses on the transaction.
So I think that, as you may have guessed, one of the reasons that we first sort of learned about you and were interested in talking to you was what Michael Lewis wrote right. in The Big Short. Mm-hmm. And specifically want to learn a little bit more about your involvement in the decision for FP to leave right. the multi-sector CDO business mm-hmm. as it was based on right. subprime underlying assets. Mm-hmm. So it says, I think that, and if you want, I brought this book because I didn't know if it would be helpful or not to use it, but I think on page, what I think we can do is go through the book,
yep.
and then we can maybe have just a discussion after that
yep.
about, I mean, this will prompt some things,
okay.
but also there may be, you know, more questions and different types of things that we'll want to ask you.
Okay.
Do you, so I'm going to start on page 86,
okay.
where it says that you brought up at a meeting, let me see if I can give you the exact.
Can I say one thing before you go?
Sure.
So I did speak to Michael Lewis. I spoke to Michael Lewis as a favor to a friend, Jake DeSantis, who wrote that
letter.
In the New York Times.
Yeah, so he called me up the day he wrote that letter, and he's like, oh, you know, you got to do me a favor. Michael Lewis wants to talk to you. He's going to write a book in a few months, and just, he's a great guy. You should speak to him. So I did speak to him. The other thing that I should warn you is that he probably spoke to about 15 people at AIG. You know, not that he tells me, but I kind of just know from. So this, although I think he did a, by the way, I think he did a fantastic job with this book, and I think it, for the most part, it's very accurate. But not surprisingly, there are some inaccuracies in the story, and there's a lot of things in here, even on this in this chapter, which I can tell you, I didn't tell him. So there's a lot of stuff there where, you know, it's coming from other people. So
I think that that's, well, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, and look, obviously, however you want to proceed, but Gene, as I think you probably can already tell, can tell you a very full account of the first moment that he started looking about at this and thinking about this that's more accurate than, and with the caveat that it's, there's some significant things that are not correct.
So I think what makes sense is, maybe it does make sense just to get your story first.
Mm-hmm. And then
well, I do want to make sure, though, that we go through it. I think it's really actually important that you're here and that we do talk about it, because I want to know what you think is accurate, what you think is inaccurate, what actually came from you, and what actually came from other people. Because
right.
to the extent that there's something that's inaccurate or not the full picture in here,
right.
it's just going to help us.
Right.
So this just gives a snapshot, and we're talking to other people as well, looking at documents as well, and this is by no means
right.
you know, the full account that
yeah.
we're relying on,
right.
but we do want your
yeah.
story, and
right.
it definitely sort of raises some issues
yeah.
about the business that they were in and,
mm-hmm.
and leaving it and
right.
that sort of stuff, and what people knew at the time about sure. the actual risks involved in the business.
Right.
So well, maybe it makes sense
okay.
then for, why don't you just go ahead and walk us through
yeah.
your involvement and how you first raised it.
Okay. It's actually it's not that long of a story, so
okay.
it's actually fairly easy to get through. And because the time period is like within six months. And by the way, one thing I will warn you, and I've noticed this even just walking through this story multiple times with our lawyers, is that I jumble. Sometimes I get the timing wrong and stuff like that. So it's I have trouble remembering what I ate last night. So 5 years ago, it's a little tough. But I, you know, there's certain things that are pretty clear. So just. I just want to use that as a...
Sure, and if there are things that you know you may be remembering
yeah.
slightly off, or you're not
yeah.
sure if you remember it correctly, then just, you know, let
yeah.
us know.
Yeah.
But we'll keep that in
yeah.
mind.
So basically, I basically sat right next to Alan Frost, and who was the guy who originated all this stuff. And quite frankly, there was some type of rivalry between us two. And so I've always kind of monitored what he's done, and so saw his business go from kind of almost nothing in 2002 to going gangbusters by the end of 2005. So in the background, the way I see that is not necessarily sitting next to him. It's because every week or two there are global meetings where each office would, representatives from each office would get up and basically talk about, transactions pending, transactions executed, and so forth. And so through these weekly or every 2 week meetings, you can see the progress of his business going from these sporadic deals to a really big machine business throughout 2005. But so, somewhere in the middle of 2005, there was a front page article in the Wall Street Journal which talked about New Century having an extraordinary dividend, somewhere between 10 and 12%. And it was, it was intriguing because it was talking about how all these big hedge funds were long the stock and that it's an interesting play and on the growth of the subprime market. And so I was intrigued. I was intrigued from a personal, just investing in the stock. And so, like I always do with all these other kind of ideas that I get, I pull the 10K of New Century and I start going through it, and in that, you learn, it was really my first time really learning about the subprime mortgage market. This is like the middle of 2005. And interestingly enough, it was frightening. I mean, the New Century was one of the largest originators of subprime mortgages at the time.
And this would have been based on their 2004 10K.
Yes, end of 2004 10K. So you can see kind of, and there's so many disclaimers, right? There's so many disclaimers on that, the risks of their business that, you can actually see, go through the disclaimers first and then go into it to see what to look for. And so, I probably spent about a few hours going through the 10K and doing a little research on the subprime market, but within half a day, I was scared about it. It was frightening how horrendous this business was and how, the underwriting process was ridiculous, even back then. So I remember saying, wow, okay, I'm not going to touch that.
What specific things do you remember being concerned about?
I remember the whole concept of reading about no-doc loans and the growing percentage of no-document loans. Also, just the exponential growth of that their business was a little frightening as well. The fact that a lot of the people who borrow from them also have a piggyback loan. So in addition to getting the first lien mortgage, they have a second lien mortgage. Borrowing 100 cents on the dollar. So there's a lot of those things that were going on there. You read it, it was pretty scary, in my opinion.
Was the Wall Street Journal article itself positive on New Century or negative?
It was kind of a little of both. It was interesting. It was kind of a little warning about the subprime market, but it also, from memory, and I haven't looked at this thing for 5 years, I haven't even dug it up or anything, but I just remember saying that it was intriguing enough for me to want to read a little bit more about it. And so I just remember very quickly, that day that I read the whole thing, I was like, okay, I'm not interested in this, I'm going to pass on this. And then soon thereafter, a friend was trying to buy his first house, and he doesn't have any money, and he was basically he always called me up for financial advice, and he was basically saying, hey, here's the deal, is that, you know, we'd love to buy a house. And interestingly enough, I've got two mortgages, a first lien and a second lien. My first lien is at like 5.5%, and my second lien is at 6.5%, for 80% and 20%. And so I can literally finance 100% at a weighted average of below 6%. You know, long dated, so it's like 30-year mortgages, something crazy like that. And so, and the only thing I need to do is to come up with closing costs. So it would cost a few thousand dollars to pay my lawyers and whatever. It ended up being $5,000 to $7,000 or something of closing costs. And he called me up, and he basically said, "Oh my God, I lost my job. They're not going to close. They're not going to let me close." And I was like, you know, it is what it is, you know, just don't worry about it, tell me how it goes. And a few weeks later he says, yeah, we closed. They let me the money without a job. And I was like, great, that's frightening.
Knowing he didn't have a job.
Yeah, knowing. Well, I think, you know, he had a broker, and the broker told him how to couch it with them or something like that. But, you know, that was frightening, okay? And then finally, remember, this is a huge departure of what I've always thought of. When, you know, I remember, you know, when my parents got a mortgage, they, you know, there was a huge, you know, process in which you get a loan. And it just was pretty frightening to see that. And then very soon thereafter, I read a Derivatives Week article that said that most of the ABS CDOs being originated today have an increasingly larger and larger percentage of subprime mortgages, in the order of, you know, it was like 80-90%. And that was kind of the final straw. You know, it was the final straw with also knowing that Alan's business went from doing, you know, even a year ago, 2004, you know, very small deals, few deals, to having, you know, 12 new deals a month, each, you know, $500 million or $300 to $600 million a piece, so gigantic deals, lots of them. So all that together, that's when basically. And again, I kind of, this is where I can't remember the sequence of events, but I believe that's when I went to Gary Gorton, who, if, by the way, is a friend of mine as well, colleague, you know, from the very beginning. And I said, and he's a consultant. He was a consultant. He works one or two days a week. And I was like, Gary, you know, this stuff is pretty frightening. You know, I think Alan's deals, you know, have significant amount of subprime mortgages, and do you know anything about these things? And that's when, you know, I asked him, you know, what percentage do you think, you know, these new deals are? And he had been so removed from the process, from Alan removed him years in advance. After he got his model, after he put the model together, he was removed from the process. So Gary basically didn't know, and he's just like, I guess it's like 5% or something like that, 5 or 10%. And I was like, no, I think it's actually 80 or 90%. And he's like, no, there's no chance that could be the case. And I was like, well, we need to look into it. So then I went.
Can I just interrupt for just a second? Did you think it was 80 or 90% based on the Derivatives Week article?
Derivatives
but not based on specific knowledge of the makeup of the FP deals.
No, because it was never.
Yeah, he's kind of going forward chronologically as to how his knowledge base builds.
Right. No, I just want to make sure that the knowledge
was entirely from that article.
Okay.
And then I went to Adam Budnick, who was basically, Alan was a senior guy, but Adam Budnick was his junior guy, who was actually executing all these deals. And I pulled him aside, and I said, Adam, you know, I've been reading that, you know, that these deals have a lot of subprime in them. You know, any idea what percentage these deals are? And the guy who's executing it told me it's less than 10%.
And I was like, I don't think that that's right. You should look into it. Maybe I'm missing something, but why don't you pull a deal, pull the most recent deal and tell me what it was, what it is. And I don't remember how long it took, but he eventually came back. He brought me into a room, closed the door, and he's like, Gene, I can't believe it. You know, it's like 80 or 90% or something like that. And he's the guy who's executing the deals, right? So that's a little frightening, to be honest with you.
Just so I understand, would it have been, I think in the corporate credit side, you mentioned that the bank would send the deal terms and the portfolio, mm-hmm. and then that would be sent to London,
yep.
and some analyst in London would
yep.
decide maybe there are some that we need to kick out.
Exactly.
Would that process have also been true? I mean, I'm just
yes.
trying to figure out if Budnick would have been the person looking at.
I believe that the process was he would send the spreadsheet he got from the bank and send it over to London, and there were analysts there in Andrew Forrester's team who kind of dissected it and looked at it, decided what to do. What they were looking at is beyond me, but that process was definitely going on, that there was a process where they send over the portfolio, some negotiation, and it gets executed.
I also wanted to ask
yeah.
Quickly about, you said that Gorton was removed from the process.
Yeah.
Could you explain that in a little bit
more
detail?
Yeah, so there was a, you know, I don't know if it was in that conversation or follow-up conversations, but we talked about it, and it was probably in follow-up conversations when I followed up with him and said, you know, Adam tells me it's, you know, whatever, 80 or 90%. And he couldn't believe it. He was kind of floored as well. And he explained to me the origins of his involvement, which, you know, I honestly could see it by, you know, he just wasn't working with Alan on anything. But basically, once the model was produced, Alan...
And this was in sort of 02?
This was probably in 02, yeah, is my guess. Alan took the model and he started running it himself. And, you know, figured, you know, these things are all kind of the same, so I can just, you know, bring in the inputs and run it and so forth. But the importance of that point is that the business for ABS CDOs dramatically changed from the beginning of 2000 to 2005. It went from literally... The ABS CDO business was a perfectly fine business to write super senior protection on when it originated, because it was in my opinion, because it involved they were called kitchen sink deals almost, where you had no more than between 5 and 10% allocated to all these different high grade asset classes, such as AAA credit card deals, AAA commercial mortgage-backed securities, prime mortgages, AAA student loan deals, or, you know, basically a hodgepodge of uncorrelated asset classes in a diversified portfolio, all encompassing this ABS CDO. So kind of the models that were created assumed uncorrelated asset classes, and that's the only way you can securitize stuff, is you have to have a very diversified portfolio. You can't securitize or carve up. The simplest way to look at it is, if you have terrible credits, there are ways, if you have a diversified portfolio of terrible credits, there are ways to carve, as long as that portfolio is massively diversified and granular, there are ways to carve up the risks by allocating losses sequentially from the equity tranche up to the super senior, and sizing this appropriate subordination, where you can actually create a high grade exposure, a tranche with very low risk, and therefore, you know, low return profile, but low risk. But it all is premised on the fact that you have to rely upon the law of large numbers, and you have to have a diversified portfolio. If you have a diversified portfolio of uncorrelated assets, you can stress test the losses and you just size where the appropriate attachment point is. And there is a point, whether it's 10% or 50% or 75%, where there is a AAA layer. but it all is based on a diversified portfolio of assets. The problem, you know, and so the ABS CDO business started off that way, and the models were created that way. But what ended up happening, not surprisingly, is the street, the banks who are originating this stuff, they're trying to find the cheapest assets you can possibly find to put into these pools because it generates the most underwriting profits or margins. So they're trying to find the cheapest asset for its rating category. So they're trying to find the, if it's a portfolio of triple B credits, I want to find the cheapest triple B ABS asset out there. And not surprisingly, the cheapest one for its rating was the subprime market. And, you know, Wall Street picked up on that really early on, and they increased that bucket from 5% to 10% to 20%, and exponentially, where by the end of 2005, it was almost 100% of the asset pool. And by the way, you know, this is my, this is not like, I'm not sitting here kind of, there's probably no document that tells you that that's what happened, but this is just kind of more of my understanding of the market, how the rating agencies are involved, the motivations from dealers or banks. And so what ended up happening is that, you know, there's this, you know, finding the cheap assets and increasing that exposure to that asset to make, create as much underwriting profits as you can.
So you said that you participated in weekly or bi-weekly meetings.
Yep.
You weren't involved directly in the multi-sector business until 2006, but you participated in weekly meetings or bi-weekly meetings.
The whole company did.
Okay. Okay. And would those, did you ever hear discussion in those meetings about the growing percentage of mortgage-backed assets in the...
Yeah, it was never, that's the fascinating thing, is it was never discussed. I think very early on...
Well, never? Is that...
Well, in my opinion, it was never discussed, where basically the percentage of the underlying assets, what percentage was subprime. There's no reason...
Okay, that, right? I'm sorry, I heard a different question.
My question was slightly different,
okay.
Which was there a discussion at these meetings about the increase in mortgage-backed assets in the multi-sector CDO business?
There was it was categorized as ABS CDOs, and that's it. There was from memory, there was never a it never drilled down to what the mix of the underlying is. And you can understand that in these meetings, a very high level, it's just about to talk about, you know, production and so forth. So they weren't risk meetings, they were just company-wide business meetings. And so, no, there was no discussion on whether it was prime mortgages, subprime, or anything. None of that. It was ABS CDOs. But to answer your question, there was a point, and this was roughly in the middle of 2005, where, you know, again, it was obvious to everybody in the company that there's just this incredible increase in business, and not only that, AIG FP was doing almost every single, you know, they were doing business with every single bank out there, and it was obvious on this list because it would have Merrill, you know, UBS, the entire cast of characters, very substantial trades, and the list went from being one or two a month to, like, you know, almost 20, and until he had to make the font smaller to fit it into a page, and so it became very obvious that, and by the way, that's very unusual for AIG Financial Products because the business model has always been to the place is not set up to do what I call flow business or to do high volume transactions. It really is set up to do kind of custom tailored, large, piecemeal transactions, high margin, low volume transactions. So it was unusual to see the massive volume of transactions that Alan is participating in. And I remember vividly, and I think everybody, a lot of people that I know remember the call where Joe questioned Alan in the middle of 2005 saying, how is it possible that we're doing so many of these deals with everybody? And Alan on the call basically told Joe that, hey, you know, They know that we can get these deals done. They're complicated. They know that, you know, we've developed a track record and we have a really incredible relationship with these guys. And that just set Joe off completely. And he does that all the time, and he just like went nuts on him. And I don't remember what he said, but he eventually cut himself short and said, "I want to talk to you after the meeting."
To Alan.
In front of
everybody. Why was he upset?
Because it just sounded like such a bullshit answer. I mean, it sounded like a typical marketer's answer, which is, "Oh, we're just, you know, they love us." And Joe's this guy who's a very, you know, he's a street smart guy. He's like, "That's impossible. There's no way it's because of that. There's probably something else." And so that was really his point, and it was a valid point. I remember all of us after the meeting, at least the people that I was close to, were like, you know, he's dead on. There's something wrong with that business. And, you know, for me in particular, I have to be careful about talking about that stuff at the time because, you know, I'm like the other guy. It almost looks like sour grapes from my perspective. So I was always really careful of not trying to make a big, even if it seemed a little strange, I didn't want to make a big deal about it because it really did look, it looked like I, you know, I had another motivation toward kind of doing that. So I was very careful of doing that, but, you know, apparently, you know, they had a call and, you know, it didn't stop the business from continuing. But I do remember that call, and so does a lot of other people.
So like summer of 2005?
That's probably right.
Do you think it was before or after you sort of looked into the New Century
stuff? It's all about the same time, I think, because everything's happening really quickly. And, you know, it's one of those things where, you know, when the street has, like, some type of gold mine, they just pile it on, right? And so if you took a look at that business, it probably in 2004, and you took a look at that business to the end of 2005 when we were executing, it looked, the volume went like this. It went straight up. I mean, and it was clear that there was a lot of money being made in this business, and so.
So I think this fits into the chronology, although correct me if I'm wrong. So on page 86, the last sort of half of the first paragraph carried over from this page 85 says, you put two and two together, guessed that this stuff had more subprime, and then you brought it up in a meeting, and your reward was to be hauled into a separate room by Cassano.
Right.
Is that different than...
That's not true. I mean,
because it sounds like what you're describing happened with Al Frost is...
Yes. Yes.
What he's talking about here.
Well, this never happened. The interesting thing...
What he can say is that this never happened.
Yeah.
Okay. The Al Frost thing did happen.
Yeah. And that happened in front of everybody. That was a company-wide thing, and it was short, and so nobody thought much of it. And by the way, the one thing that I think is important for you to kind of understand, like, what's going on is, for most senior folks of the company, I can tell you, at least from my perspective, I really cared what risks AIG Financial Products took because half of my bonuses were locked up for 5 years and accumulates as subordinated capital of the company. And so I was always very interested in what other people did, why they did it, and risks we were taking. So for purely selfish reasons, there were reasons why if something didn't really pass the smell test, it made a lot of sense for myself or any senior person in the company to say, "Hey, wait a second. So let's look at this. Let's talk about this and so forth." So the one thing that there's a lot of things that AIG Financial Products did wrong. The one thing that they did right, as a general matter, is they set up the compensation system where people act like owners, I think. I mean, I certainly acted like an owner. So that's the main reason why, you know, when all of this started coming together and it became obvious what was going on here, and I was basically, you know, talking to Gary, you know, and telling Gary, "Hey, there's a problem, you know, this is horrendous business. We should get out of it. You should talk to Andrew Forrester." And again, I go through Gary, first of all, because Gary even though he was a consultant, he had Joe Cassano's ear, and he was also, you know, just a very, he's almost like a senior advisor to the company. So I basically felt it's much better coming from him than it is from me. And so basically talked to Gary, and Gary agreed that, you know, we should probably think about getting out of this business. So I think he had a chat after our chat about, after I reported to him that Alan said that, you know, 80 or 90% of these transactions are backed by subprime, and kind of walked him through the whole subprime story. He went to Andrew Forrester in London and said, hey, you know, this is what Gene is saying, you know, you should, you know, look into this. And I believe at the time, you know, Andrew came back and said, don't worry about it, it's fine, we're on top of it, fine. And it kind of went silent.
And is that based on what Gary told you?
That's probably what Gary told me, and it's all kind of a gray area, but I do remember pushing Gary, and Gary did have a talk with Andrew, and Gary did come back to me at some point, and the chronology is a little screwed up for me, but he did come back and say that, you know, don't worry, Andrew's on top of this, don't worry about it. And it went silent for a long time.
Did he say, though, whether or not he thought Andrew was concerned? Was there more to the discussion that you remember?
The only thing I remember is that Andrew was not concerned, and that he kind of poo-pooed the whole thing, and it was kind of the end of it.
And that was through Gary?
That was through Gary.
And this would have been late summer 2005, to the best of your recollection?
Yeah, probably late summer.
About that. Is this later in 07? Because remember, I'm sorry, 05, because New Century's in the summer, your friends.
Yeah, this is
summer,
well after that whole process.
You move forward to the Derivatives Weekly article, like third quarter-ish or even later?
I think late summer, beginning of fourth quarter is probably that period of time.
So September, October.
Yeah, something like that.
Okay.
And
so I just want to clear one thing up before we move on. You said that Gordon was taken out of the process of modeling, that Al took over that. I think you then said that Gary told you that that's what happened. But I'm just wondering if you have any personal knowledge. Did you witness Al running the model by himself?
Oh, yeah. I knew that. I was able to reconcile what Gary was telling me because I think either Adam told me or something like that that he runs the model, that they run it independently, and they have run it independently for years already.
Okay, thanks.
So, yeah.
So can I just just a couple quick things? And you may have covered this because I think you were talking about it right when I walked back in.
Right.
The list that was growing bigger and the font had to get smaller to show all the deals. What did that document have a name? Was there a report that I would like to see that report to show the ballooning in the CES?
Yeah, it was the I think the meetings were every 2 weeks, and it was the global call. You can easily get, you know, copies of the global call presentations, and I think it was every 2 weeks. And it would be in the North American section, and it was ABS CDO, or super senior business off of ABS CDOs, and it would just be a listing of, you know, the bank who originated it, the notional amount, and maybe the timing when it's expected to close.
And would there be like a running total for the month?
There would be a list, a running total, but, you know, it would be interesting because you can probably go back and actually see how that list just grew over months, you know, exponentially. So.
And it's called the global call?
It's a global call presentation.
Okay.
Yeah.
Is it a PowerPoint?
Yeah, it's a PowerPoint.
Okay. And included within that PowerPoint presentation is the list.
The list, yeah, okay. Yeah. Okay. And but very light on details. Like there's nothing about the underlying transactions. Literally just.
But it would include dollar amount and number of deals.
Yeah, and the investment bank who's originating it, who's doing business with.
A couple other just follow-ups on what you've already covered. when you're going through and saying, I think it's 80 and 90, and you go to Budnick, and Budnick says, nah, it's less than 10, and then he looks and he says, holy moly, it is 80 to 90. One thought that comes to my mind immediately is, how in the world is the trader that's doing the deal not know what's behind the deal?
It's unbelievable.
Did you ask him?
I did. I mean, it was funny because after this whole, after we closed the business down and looked back, that was the question. And I was like, when he sends it to London, first of all, even when you receive a spreadsheet, how do you not look at that spreadsheet and take a look at where you're writing protection on? Whether you're a sales guy, a risk guy, or any, if you're originating the business, how do you not look at that? And secondly, who looked at it and who opined on it and who came to the conclusion that this is fine? And what's fascinating is that there are probably four or five people who looked at it and all kind of just, it's like a blind spot, They were focused on the wrong things. They were focused on, okay, who was managing, who is the CDO manager managing that ABS CDO? What's their track record? What's the percentage in California versus something else? They were focused on items that were really not relevant to the risk, and they, instead of understanding that, hey, we're taking one big bet on a correlated pool of assets, subprime, that is amazing to me that through that whole chain, really run by Andrew Forster, that no one knew what they were doing. No one.
Explain to me then, because in addition to seeing the global call PowerPoint with the list showing the increasing number of deals, I would also be interested in seeing then whatever documentation there is that shows what I guess Budnick and you saw when you finally looked at it. So what is it, a spreadsheet? Tell me what document I should ask the company for to see what the kind of collateral that is in each of these deals.
For every deal, there was a, there's always a spreadsheet that comes from the bank, originating bank, which broke out the underlying collateral by buckets in all different, sometimes ratings buckets, sometimes asset class buckets, prime, subprime, sometimes locale, what geographical distribution. So it almost takes a look at the pool from all these different angles. So the spreadsheet does that, but the easiest thing to pull up is for every deal, every single deal that was done in credit derivatives, there's a credit write-up report, which is like a 2 to 3 pager, which had to go through all of that stuff. And that was part of the process for doing any super senior credit derivative trade dating back to 2000, where a formal credit write-up would be put together and sent downtown to the parent. I keep on forgetting his name, the chief risk officer.
Bob Lewis.
Bob Lewis and his crew would have to sign off before a deal was executed. So every single one of those deals were signed off by Bob Lewis and his crew. But those write-ups are the best way of very quickly seeing. And if you pull every write-up from the beginning, you can probably see how early on these deals were, diversified pools of ABS and became almost 100% subprime through those credit write-ups.
I'm sorry. So the 2 to 3 page credit write-up report will tell us the changing percentage in the composition of the collateral?
It should. It should. From memory, I believe it should. It did.
Now, does the credit write-up have any kind of formal name? I mean, if I call AIG's lawyers and say, send me the credit write-ups, are they going to know what the heck I'm talking about?
They will.
Okay.
There's a credit write-up for the parent.
And if we already did this, and if, what about the spreadsheet? Does that have a specific name?
No, because the spreadsheets were from dealers, and they just And those are really kind of hard to parse through.
Okay. Go ahead.
Yeah.
So I think where we were was you talked to Gary Gorton.
Yeah.
You believe that he talked to Andrew Forster,
yeah.
And that the word was no worries here.
Yeah.
So what's the next sort of headline on when this issue resurfaces?
So it went silent for a couple of months till the end of the year, and that's when there was a little shake-up where, because of all the, you know, Alan was getting a higher, a bigger profile due to the amount of transactions that were, he was generating. And not surprisingly, it was right across all of the big banks. And not surprisingly, these banks took him really seriously. I mean, he would meet, you know, Stan O'Neill at a golf outing. He was getting, you know, he was the golden goose for the entire, not surprisingly, for the entire street. And this was a huge, huge business for Wall Street at this time. And so that profile he had within the banks caused Joe to want to kind of create this new position for him, saying, okay, you've created this machine, why don't you pass it on, and why don't you be kind of this, you know, this ambassador to the street for our company, where you just drum up all these other different businesses, just like you did the subprime, but at a very high level, go to all the different groups. And so that was, he was being promoted to this new job at the end of 2005, December 2005. And so they had to find some lackey to take over his his business. And that's where I came in. And unfortunately, there was no other obvious choice other than me. And so the decision was to, and this decision was probably made before it was told to me, but was that I would take that over. Adam Budnick, who was his junior guy, would work for me. We'd continue running this machine. I would now report to Andrew Forrester in London. And so somewhere, I think at the end of December, John Capetta, who was my boss then, pulled me aside and told me, "Congratulations! Here's your new job, and you're going to be reporting Andrew." And that's when I kind of told John, like, you know, this is a horrendous business, and I really have no interest in doing this. And he basically suggested that I go to London, meet with Andrew Forrester, my new boss, and his team, talk to him about it, and take it from there. And so, soon thereafter, we, you know, arranged a meeting to go to London, speak to Andrew about this, and start the new year running this business. And so this all is happening very quickly. So very quickly, I'm on a fly over there, and, you know, go right into a meeting with Andrew and just laid it out. Just started off with basically saying, listen, I've been monitoring this business, and by the way, he knew my posture already, but didn't kind of really let me in on it at the beginning. But I just told him, I was like, listen, if you want me to run this, I quit. You can let someone else do this.
You told Forrester this?
Yeah, I said, that's kind of the way I wanted to deliver the message. I didn't want him to think that there was any kind of gray area where he can convince me to, you know, to do this, because, like I said, I mean, I have nothing against making money. I have something against losing a lot of money. And it was, to me, it was one of those things where it's just, I did not want to participate in it. And so I spent basically a couple hours with Andrew, walking him through the whole subprime story. Shockingly enough, I mean, he just, you know, didn't really seem like he knew much about the subprime business. He didn't know much about the way these deals were constructed. So, you know, and the way I come to that conclusion is that, you know, having spoken to Andrew before, it was just dead silence. You know, I'm sitting here explaining stuff, no questions, no nothing. And you know, and by the way, you know, I'm trying to simplify things a little. the deals in particular that AIGFP were doing were not great. I mean, they were not just subprime; they were actually levered subprime exposures through CDOs. And so, there's this whole story of why, in particular, the business that we were doing is there's no chance it's super senior, which means that, you know, getting paid 15 basis points to take real risk. I mean, who gets paid 15 basis points to? I mean, that's nothing. And it's like, you know, you should be paid a lot of money to take this risk. And so you just decide to get out. It's not a question of pricing. It's not like you can say, hey, you know, we were 15 basis points today and we changed our mind and now we need 50% premiums here. That just doesn't work, you know. So you're either in or you're out. So I walked through all of this stuff. It was silence on his end, but he said, okay, I understand some of your points. He said, why don't you just, you know, calm down and just, you know, go back. Why don't you do a little bit more research? We'll do a little bit more research here, and let's get together in like a week or so, the whole team.
Are we in January now?
January now.
Okay.
Get together, you know, the whole team, and go through this whole thing properly. And so that's what we agreed to do.
So just to interrupt for a quick second, on page 88, the book says that you told Joe Cassano that if you were forced to take the job, you'd quit. So that was actually
Andrew Forster, not
Cassano. Okay.
Yeah. What's
did you ever talk directly to Cassano at this point about this?
No.
Okay.
Which is interesting. It's not even at this point. At any point, you know, one thing that if I had a there are a couple of inaccuracies here, but one thing that's very inaccurate is Joe's involvement. He was, you know, he's the CEO of a very large company. This business was not that large of a business for the company, and that, you know, he really wasn't, you know, involved.
In this stream of events that you've been talking about.
Yes, yeah. Especially, I mean, so I never talked to, I don't think I talked once to Joe, other than, again, later on, I did have to send him an email about the reasons why we're getting out of this business, a formal email. Other people were CC'd, but I don't think I've ever actually spoken to him about it.
Okay.
And that all dialogue goes through Andrew Forster. And that was just the way things worked.
Okay. Thanks for letting me interject there.
Yeah,
so
no,
feel
no.
free to keep going.
Yeah. So basically, we went back. I spent a week with Adam Budnick, a whole bunch of other people, and just trying to dig up as much information about the deals that we were doing, subprime business, ABS CDOs, how they were constructed, our involvement in them, the process, and all that sort of stuff. And spent literally a week kind of researching all that and developing a case of why. And by the way, the more I read, the more it became pretty obvious that, you know, this is, we got to get out of this stuff as soon as possible. So, you know, roughly a week later, we had a video conference where Andrew and his entire team was on the other side, myself, in Connecticut, myself, Gary Gorton, Alan Frost, Adam Budnick were attending on our side. And the purpose of this meeting was to, you know, discuss our involvement in this business going forward. And by the way, by this time, Alan got a whiff of what was going on here. And, you know, not surprisingly, you know, he was, you know, we didn't have the greatest relationship to start off with. It was even worse. It was just, he just did not want to talk to me, and he was very quiet about everything. So, very clearly conflicted, you know.
At this point, he's in a new job.
He's in a new job. He just started a new job. So he really, and he's still kind of handing stuff off, but he's very short with me and all that sort of stuff. And he kind of knows where I'm going because of discussions I've had with Adam, discussions I had with Andrew Forster. So, you know, at this meeting, you know, it was literally, I didn't realize that I was going to do all the talking, but it was literally, you know, I basically spent like an hour or so kind of walking through why I think this business is just a disaster and why we should just get out of it.
What research had you done in that intervening week?
Read a lot about, well, took a look at the deals and how the deals were structured. Took a look, I mean, and, you know, again, this is where one's eyes start to roll back because it starts to go into nuances that I, quite frankly, I don't think are that relevant. But basically, AIG's role, there are two forms of securitization. Basically, AIG's role is actually one step removed from the subprime origination market. So there are all these banks who are originating pools of subprime mortgages. In a lot of cases, you know, third-party agents, you know, get paid an upfront fee, and they generate these mortgages, which are then pooled together and then sold to an investment bank, who then carves that pool of assets into a securitization.
A mortgage-backed security.
A mortgage-backed security. So let's just say that's the first securitization, the mortgage-backed security. And in that mortgage-backed security, you've got an equity tranche, triple B tranche, single A, double A, triple A, and super senior. So you create this tower, and that's the first securitization, the RMBS. AIG didn't play a role until the second securitization, which is the people, a vast majority of the people who bought that first securitizations were CDOs, so these special purpose vehicles who actually bought tranches of that first securitization. And there are two types of ABS CDOs. There's a high-grade ABS CDO and a mezzanine ABS CDO. The high-grade buys the AAA tranche, the super senior AAA, you know, double A, single A tranches, and the mezzanine ABS CDO buys all the triple B minus to triple B plus tranches. So basically, that first RMBS securitization is almost entirely placed to a ABS CDO split between a high grade and a mezzanine by complete, in some cases, two different managers, totally different deals. They all buy pieces of all these RMBS securitizations being originated.
And that was sort of a uniform definition across the street?
Yes.
Okay.
So if I understand this correctly, there are two securitizations coming out of the original securitization. There's the one that's all AAA and one that's all triple B.
Single A, double A, triple A.
Well, okay.
But for the most part, yes. High grade.
All high grade. And then
mezzanine is triple B.
Yeah, but there is a security that's all mezzanine.
Yes, yes, okay. Exactly. And it's all mezzanine, it's all triple B assets in a mezzanine ABS CDO. But by the way, these are not all linked. They're all, you know, you've got all these ABS CDO managers with different banks. They're all buying pieces of other people's deals. So when one deal gets originated, the AAA, AA, single A might get parsed out to 10 different managers of high-grade CDOs, ABS CDOs, and the triple Bs might get parsed out to 10 different, you know, mezzanine ABS CDO managers who are putting it into their deals. But these are not all linked. They're all kind of, everybody's running their own little businesses. But these ABS CDOs are sopping up almost all the demand for that first securitization, which drives the origination. So all this cash is coming in to drive the subprime origination market through these ABS CDOs. And so the business that AIG was doing was they were writing super senior protection off of both high grade and mezzanine ABS CDO. So two separate deals, and what they do is for the mezzanine deals, there might be 50 triple B tranches of different ABS CDOs, all backed by subprime. And the rating agencies would rate a securitization where you carve up, you know, losses there, losses allocated sequentially from the equity up, where you can actually create an equity tranche all the way up to a super senior tranche off of this triple B pool of 50 subprime RMBS transactions. A lot of stuff
so
is strange.
Actually, I have a question just to sort of flesh out my understanding of how it worked at FP. If FP is writing protection on both MES CDOs and high-grade CDOs, if you know, would the model that was being used to assess the appropriate attachment point spit out a higher attachment point for MES CDOs?
Absolutely, significantly higher. So that was the main...
So the model did recognize...
Yes, so that, in fact, that was the main... That's the main difference from... If you look at these deals, you could see that of all the high super senior tranches of high-grade deals, the attachment point might be 15%. So losses in excess of 15%.
Meaning that you're writing protection on 85% of the deal.
On 85% of the deal. But on the MES deals, it was 30%. So, twice as much subordination because they're triple B assets as opposed to a weighted average double A asset. And so the model would spit out that, super senior attachment point is 30, and therefore if we attach it 31, 32, we're covered. So that's exactly what's going on, is if you take a look at those, all the MES deals have a much higher attachment point. But you can see that that's entirely AIGFP's position in the market, is not the first securitization, because the first securitization is sold almost entirely to these ABS CDO managers and deals, and that they were participating in 85% of the capital structure, top 85% on high-grade deals, and the top 70% on mezzanine deals, where they write the entire protection. And the deal sizes were, $300 to $500 million. In some cases, the Goldman deals were $1 billion. So they're very, very large transactions, getting paid between 10 and 15 basis points, which really didn't fluctuate during this whole period of time as well. Large notionals, and very model-based decisions.
So during this week, you're sort of assessing the business that FP's been in so far.
And just to be clear, you had done research at the end of the third quarter or December, besides reading the Wall Street Journal article in the Century, besides your friend, besides Derivatives Weekly, besides the question you had started that
reading.
Then.
So probably, just reading, paying more attention to deals getting done, and talking to, remember, I talk to the same banks he does, except different groups. So just trying to understand what's going on in the market and all that sort of stuff. So this is all not happening in a short period of time. It's happening over a longer period of time. But, one of the more frightening things about, for example, the mezzanine ABS CDOs, and this was one of my big points, not only, the fundamentals of the underlying assets, subprime mortgages, are flawed because, one of the issues that were pretty obvious is that even though AIGFP was wrapping or writing protection on the ABS CDOs, the banks had to provide summary data on the, if you drill down to the underlyings, what, the geographical concentrations are on the underlying subprime mortgages. So there's almost like a two-step analysis where you can take a look at, okay, I own the triple B tranches of these 50 deals and some summary statistics of that, but if you drill down to those triple Bs, then these are the subprime mortgage pools that are underlying these things, and you can see geographical diversification. But one of the scariest statistics, even at that stage, was that the increase in there are two very very significant issues about the underlying subprime mortgage market at that time, which is the no-doc loan, which is exactly what you think it is, and it literally is no documentation whatsoever. Just someone says, "I make $500,000 a year, so give me $300,000 mortgage," with no one checking or anything like that. So the no-doc loan, there was also this issue which was understood with where, if you think about it, a significant amount of these mortgages were originated by people who are just flipping things. So a mortgage broker is getting paid an upfront fee. They don't care what happens once their fee gets paid. So they literally are figuring out ways of just selling as much volume as they can, and they know exactly what are the requirements for whoever's aggregating these things are just to get by. And the, you know, the bank who's originating it usually doesn't hold on to it. They sell it to someone else. So all of these people at the front line who are originating this don't care what these things look like, as long as they have someone else to take them out. And so that's one of the big problems that occurred, is that, you know, you have banks who really don't care who they're originating to, as long as they have a takeout. And the CDO market was their takeout. So they were lending to everybody. They're getting appraisals that are bogus in a lot of cases. So rampant fraud that was even at that time. If you just search the internet at the time, you can see how there's a lot of, it's like the underbelly of society, the mortgage brokers, the origination, and it was you know, pretty bad even back then.
We can take a break too if you want to.
If you don't mind.
Let me ask this quick question. If we've got the entire securitization process of the mortgages, subprime or otherwise, is the reason that the demand comes through CDOs because you need the mezz CDO to take up the B, triple B, double
really,
B?
Yeah.
Is the reason because my first question was, well, why wouldn't you just stop at the securitization point and just sell out the tranches of the securitization? And then I wondered, well, maybe it's because you can't sell the lower tranches of the securitization?
If any part of that machine disappears, the whole thing stops. So if the RMBS securitization, that first securitization, if any one of those players stopped providing, taking stuff out, everything beforehand has to come to a grinding halt, right? Because this is all about people flipping mortgages into these things, and the person who's left holding the bag is the people who own the ABS CDOs, because, like I said, if you really took a look at the capital structure, the triple B tranche attachment point might be like, you know, 7% or 7 to 10%. So 90% of all deals were being placed into ABS CDOs, and that was driving all of the demand for the subprime mortgages to some extent. If the ABS CDO machine stopped, you can almost be certain that the subprime mortgage market would stop, because all of those guys would be, you know, they'd aggregate these terrible mortgages and they try to sell it, and then suddenly the music stops and they're left with it. And that's what happened.
There was no one else to take it,
and in some cases,
as
soon as the music stopped, all of the mortgage originators like New Century went bankrupt immediately. And then they stopped lending, and so that entire market ended. But you can see how that whole chain ending with the ABS, and the funny thing is there's one other securitization there. You know, once you have a high grade and a mezzanine CDO, those get sold into CDO squares. That's great. So you know, you literally sell the double A tranche of an ABS CDO mezzanine deal into a CDO squared. So it was just almost crazy, and rating agencies are involved in all the way through.
So we can stop here. I'm just going to make a note that we're getting to the point of talking about the reconvening a week later after you talked to Andrew. So start there.
Good.
So do you want to just take 10 minutes?
Yeah.
I'll show you.